Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to author G.D. Grace's A Touch of Grace, Literary Magic, on Blog Talk Radio.
Today's broadcast is dedicated to one of the legends in show business who passed away back on May 9, 2010. The late Lena Horne's beauty was destined to take her places in lives that not many of us would ever see. She lit up both stage and film with an eloquent grace and class that drew you into her performances. From Stormy Weather to If You Believe from The Wiz, you believed in love, hope, and faith in your own abilities to rise and become who you were destined to be. Upon her shoulders we stand, and she will be remembered today as being a trailblazer in entertainment and star that will forever shine. People of the world, I am your host, GD. Welcome to iArtist Presents on A Touch of Grace. Today's date is Thursday, February 27, 2014, and the time, 1:30 p.m. This is going to be an encore presentation of a show back on January 17, 2014. I'm not really sure where today's guest is. I know that he was having some, he had just landed somewhere, and I'm not sure if he was having troubles getting through the gate or what, but I am going to have a show here for you today. Imagine that. K.L. Belvin is a prime example of what happens when you allow God to take control of your life. This is an encore presentation of the interview that I did with the dean and educator in the New York City school system. Everyone, thanks for tuning in to A Touch of Grace. And here's the encore presentation of the interview with K.L. Belvin.
Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to author G.D. Grace's A Touch of Grace, Literary Magic, on Blog Talk Radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, I am your host, GD. Welcome to iArtist on A Touch of Grace. Today's date is Friday, January 17, 2014, and the time is 1:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. K.L. Belvin is a prime example of what happens when you allow God to take control of your life. He is a father of six, a dean, and an educator of students for the New York City Department of Education, where he's been for over 16 years. He is a Christian and the co-founder of Braven Publishing, LLC, a place where he cultivates the talents of authors interested in having a thriving writing career. In June 2008, he released his first manuscript called A Man in Transition, which is a book of poems, stories, and personal observations. With his wife, Tiffany Braxton Belvin, at his side, Braven Publishing, LLC was born in the year of 2010. He has produced over 14 more titles, ranging from, now get this, poetry, history, self-help, anthologies, romantic drama, urban fiction, and urban science fiction. He is currently celebrating a second book, From Gigolos to Jesus, which discusses his journey from being a whore to a man of God, and the adverse effects of being exposed to pornography too early in life. I am pleased to have him on the show today. K.L. Belvin, welcome to the show. How has your week been?
Oh, man, my weekend is going great, and I appreciate you having me on. Thank you so much. Thank you for the intro.
Well, you know what? It's an honor to have someone doing so much for our youth, because they certainly need direction out there. So I think it's a great thing that both you and your wife are doing. And so we've got a lot of talk. Oh, no worries. We've got a lot of talk about today. Lot to talk about today. And there's no better place than to start at the beginning. So where were you born and what led you to the calling of literary expression? Oh.
All right. Well, I was born in South Jamaica, Queens, Jamaica, New York. And my call, as funny as it's all intertwined, my writing came from my want to get closer to women sexually. So what I figured out was women like artistic things, women like poetry, women like erotic stories. So I was an erotic poet and an erotic story writer, and I found that by using my poetic skills, I could get around women's defenses, be the gentleman, be whatever I needed, whatever they needed me to be, and I let that shine through in my writing. And, of course, you cause a stimulation by writing things that are of erotic nature, which causes a curiosity factor to build, and then you take it from there. So that's really where my writing had taken its birth and had laid itself for quite some time until I changed my life and changed my focus.
All right. Well, it sounds like there was definitely an epiphany, and those are always great along the road in life, because that's what it's all about. It's about evolving and getting better and learning that mistakes are just only platforms for us to get better. So you are also a husband, as I mentioned, and a father of six, and you have a large family. So it's cited that the six children are with five different women, and that there have been 25 miscarriages and abortions combined. So the question that I have for you, because that's a lot of lot to go through, what did that do to your soul, and how did you overcome?
Well, at the time that you're doing it, or the time that you're going through it, you don't really concern yourself with your soul. You're more concerned about what you want. And as a misogynist, most misogynists don't care what the outcome is. They're only concerned about what they can achieve, who they can conquer. Well, my soul didn't come into the picture until around 06, 04, 05, 06, those last couple of years where the things that I was doing were not sustaining me and the unhappiness was building. And when I look back at it, the one thing I know when dealing with folks who are going through the same thing is that you can hide the unhappiness very well, but at the end of the day, it'll start to build. And if you do not deal with it, it starts to become a cancer, because you either go out and try to do more of the negative to try to drown out that voice, or eventually you have to deal with it. I'm not proud of my history. I'm not proud of the way my children were conceived, but I love my children. I'm not proud of the number of abortions and miscarriages, and actually when I wrote my book, it was very difficult to even go through that, because I had to write that book and that chapter through the eyes of the man that I am now, not through the eyes of that man that I was. And so you worry about your soul, but this is where faith plays a major role in my life now. In reading the scriptures, I realized that Paul, who was Saul before he was felled and the Lord blinded him on his route to Damascus, he became Paul. Things that he would do when he would introduce himself to people, he would introduce himself as Paul. And then once you got comfortable and he got you to understand that he was a man of God doing the things that he was doing, he would then remind you that he was Saul, or you knew him as Saul. And people would go, the same Saul that was murdering Christians? Yes. And he left the weight with you. You had to decide whether you wanted to judge the man that you really came to see or what you knew or thought you knew about the man before. So I took my solace in this. I said, well, I'm not that man. I've asked the Lord to forgive me. I've changed my mindset. I've changed my outlook. I've changed everything about my life. I am not going to be held hostage to what people think about what I was. The only thing I can do and the only thing that I've done is try to live forward and live focused on how I can change things now and to prevent women, children, anybody else from dealing with men who are like I was.
All right. Well, you know, I think your confession and your honesty, a courage rose up from that to where you were confident enough in knowing what the mistakes were, identifying them, and changing them and turning yourself around. So what lessons did you learn from the life that you led? And how did it shape the man that you are today?
Oh, wow. Interesting question. What I've learned is that everything that you do to someone else for personal gain can be devastating in their lives. Even things that you think are very minuscule, heartaches, lies, disrespect, anything that you do to someone that's negative can have monumental damage to that person. To learn that a couple of the women that I had dealt with that had abortions could no longer produce children. To have children that you can't, even though you want to be the best father possible, because of time and distance, you can't be the type of father that you would like to be. So you have to be the father that you can within the constraints of the circumstances that are in place, and know that you created those circumstances or aided in those circumstances. Also, the fact that with the number of women, and that's another thing that wasn't mentioned, I've been with over 300 women, and I don't say that to brag and I don't say that to boast. I say that because I say this when I talk to kids. That's 300 women that have intimate knowledge of what my wife and I share, and they shouldn't have that. And I have to live with that. And you also have to live knowing that that devastation that you created, some of those people may not find the comfort that you found. So the comfort that you have came at a cost. So you can either, like some people, they even revel in it. I don't. I use that as motivation to try to make sure no one else has to suffer from that. I also learned that at some point you have to at least extend an apology to those individuals. Even if they don't accept it, that's neither here nor there for you. You have to at least offer that and give them an opportunity to tell you, I'll never forgive you. Okay, well, then that's on you. I'm only asking because I'm not that man. And people will not believe you. You also have to deal with the ridicule of, no matter how much you say you've changed, people are not going to believe a word that you say or even the things that they see you do, even though they're positive. You still got to stay focused because you created that. So once you accept that you are no longer that person, you have to be comfortable enough to deal with any weight or any blowback that's going to come from it. And that lesson has been a very foundational one for me, because I do not allow myself to get caught up in the past. I pull from the past what I need to focus on what I'm doing now, because if I really just reveled in it, I'd never be able to move forward. So when you do that, people automatically say, you don't care. No, I don't express my outwardly feelings unless I'm writing or unless I'm the things I'm passionate about, because sometimes we can be emotional about things we don't need to be, and it prevents us from going forward. So my biggest lesson is just use what you need. Use what you need and leave the rest where it is in the past.
Well, you know what? I think that you said it so eloquently. I'm going to really enjoy going back listening to this broadcast, because you made some good points on that. And
thank you.
It really is. Oh, yeah, man. It's really about and that's the biggest thing about forgiveness. You know, because forgiveness really is divine. When you go back and you try to make amends with other people, you're not doing it for them, so to speak. You are really doing it for yourself to release those demons of the past transgressions that led you to, like you said, do some of the things that you did when you were in that moment. And as a result of that, you know, there is a soul awakening that definitely does happen, but it doesn't happen until after you identify and come to a personal truth about what you've done. Now, an interesting thing that I see is that something was made possible because of your spiritual awakening. You found about one of your children 26 years later and reconnected with your old father after 39 years. So would you say that these reconciliations were made possible by a personal spiritual awakening?
Oh, without question. Listen, I owe everything to the Lord. I'm going to keep it real. If I offend anybody that's listening, I apologize. I'm a Christian, and I make no bones about it. Jesus Christ is my Lord and Savior, and it is what guides my life. And as I say often, I'm not trying to offend anybody, but I live by certain rules. And those rules are I speak openly about my Savior. Once I was able to change my life, and I use this when I speak, first it was my wonderful wife, who girlfriend at the time, who put up with all that foolishness. Well, once we got married, 2 years later, right before we got married, I got saved 2 years before, I sat down and I said, I'm going to write my father a letter, because my aunt had said, you two need to get together. And I said, I'm not keeping us apart. I've never met him. I don't know him. I've tried to find him, and I keep hearing people say how I look like him. Okay. So I wrote him. I got his information. I sent him an email, and I sent him some pictures of my sons and my wife and I at the time we were dating. And I said, listen, I would understand if you don't want to have anything to do with me, because we have not talked at this point, but I just want you to know who I am. what I'm about, what I'm doing. I don't need you, but I would love to get to know you. And I'm going to leave that up to you. And he said he read the email 100 times. And then I remember one afternoon I got a call, and he was like, this is your father. Now, first of all, when you're an independent man like I have, who has never conformed to the idea of having a father, a man saying this is your father, it almost came off as an insult. So I was like, yeah, okay, how you doing? And we talked, and then he said, but I'm going to keep it very real with you. And what's funny is he said some of the same things I said. Now, I'm going to tell you something about my father in a second that will blow your mind. But I said, okay. He said, but before we go any further, I'm going to tell you, I was doing some things in the past, and we need to have a blood test because, you know, I got to check. I just can't lay claim to a child who calls out of the blue and says, you're my son. And I said, I wouldn't expect anything less. I would do the same thing, and I was out here running these streets, so I understand. So he sent the blood test, and because you can't buy him, at the time, you couldn't buy him in New York. He sent the blood test. I took it, sent back all the samples. A couple of weeks later, we both got results and said, 99 point whatever, I'm his son. So at that point, he opened up the door. We started talking, and from the time talking on the phone, we agreed to meet in South Jersey. We both have family connections back in South Jersey, and so we met down there. And it was interesting because I have a brother who is this is his father also, but he has a different mother. And so him and I had connected, and that's a whole other story too. And we agreed that we was going to sit down. He said, I don't want to meet this man. What are you going to tell? I said, relax. We have children, and them children and those children need to know their grandfather. Well, he was on his way to the hotel, but my father got there first. My father and I got a chance to sit down and talk. And when I opened the door and I saw that he stood a couple inches taller than me, and I'm 6'5", so him standing about 6'3", 6'4", was interesting because here I had to look up to him, another thing I'm not really used to. So we sat down, and he starts to explain where his mindset was back then. And then at that time, my brother had showed up. He sat down. And here we were, both the same age, because my brother the same age as me, two 39-year-old men, like little boys, listening to their father. And he ran down everything. We sat there for almost 3.5 hours. And this man, who I had never met, is telling my story. And now here's what I'm going to get to my son, too, in a second. Here's what I'm going to give you that people may not believe it. You call it what it was. This is how I know God was at work. My father, who I had never met, only had a picture, had a son named Elijah. I had a son named Elijah. He is 9 years older than his wife. I am 9 years older than my wife. He likes full-figured women. I love full-figured women. Actually, he loves full-figured women, too. His wife is an early riser. We're both night owls. They were married in August. I was married in August. He has six kids. He has seven kids. I have six kids, and now with my wife having our going to have our latest in March, I'm on my way to seven. We have the same amount of kids. And I got my wife pregnant at the same age my youngest brother, his last child, was conceived. And when this child was born this year, I'm 46. That was the age that he had his last child. Now, how could two men who have never met each other have so much in common if it not be the Lord? Ain't that much coincidence in the world. And so,
much of a spiritual awakening. I mean, all the numbers.
Exactly,
wow.
Exactly. And I needed him more at 39. Then I did at 19, because at 19 I wouldn't have heard him. I was so caught up in who I was or thought I was at 19 that we probably would have fought. Because like most young men who grew up without a father, I had shaped this understanding of life around I don't need any man, because my mother didn't teach me that. It's that when you grow up and deal with things in the streets of New York or any type of urban area, you become tough simply by doing it yourself. So why did I need a father? But at 39 I did. Because at 39, my life was changing. And here, we had both changed our lives. We had both found the Lord. We were both calling out to the Lord to heal the things that we had did wrong. So we're praising the same God without knowing each other.
God,
you know, and these are things, and then leading to my son, now 2 years later, 2 years later, I meet my son who, after 26 years, his mother finally told the truth that I was his father. And I had ran in, and I had spoken to her when he was 2 years old. She said, no, that's not your son. Ran into her again 10 years later when he was 12, and we were joking. I said, when are you going to tell me that's my son? Because people say he looked like me. She said, it's not your son. Just relax. Okay, fine. I'm not going to keep trying to find a child. I got enough. So when he moved into my old apartment building people that still lived there that knew me when I was growing up as a kid said, you look just like this dude, Keith. You look just like this dude. And he kept saying, Mom, who is this guy, Keith, that everybody keeps saying I look like? What's going on? Some of the same things that I was saying about my own father. She said, you know what, I got to come clean. He could be your father, but I'm really not sure. Now, that tells you something about her lifestyle. I already spoke about my own. So when he reached out, now I was on the other side of the table. The Lord had already prepared me what to say to him because I had already went through it with my own father. So that lineage of negativity that was in place before us was now slowly being broken because now the positionings was different. The conversation was different, and I knew what to do because I had healed myself through my father. So at 39, I was preparing for, at 41, what to say to a son now who was going to be seeing me for the first time over a 20-year period because I knew what my father said to me. And we've been all cool. Now, those two haven't met yet, which I'm still working on, and this is a whole lot of things, but that is what folks have to understand is that there are things going on that are in place that you couldn't say a coincidence. That's why my faith is so strong.
Such a powerful, powerful testimony. You said everything that I wanted to address, the dynamic. You know, first you had to do it with your father, and then the tables were turned, and it was reversed where you had to, mm-hmm. your son had to do it with you. So there's just so much in that, and I know that somebody that's listening, I know and I pray that somebody tunes in and gets out of it what I did. You know, I didn't have the same. I had a similar situation with my father, but it mm-hmm. definitely was not like that. I mean, I knew that he was my father, and him and my mother's thing didn't work out, and they moved apart. And, you know, of course, when you talk about women, some women use children as a ploy, you know.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, to kind of keep them apart, but it definitely worked out. So, very great. I don't need
my
to add anything.
My father worried about that. I'm sorry to cut you off. My father worried about that because that was one of his concerns. He said, I thought your mother had poisoned the water, so I kept my distance. All those years, he thought my mother had made me anti him when actually my mother did none of the sort. My mother actually never said anything negative about him, and I didn't know he was my father because my mother married another man, and that was my sister's father. She had me believing that was my father simply because she didn't want to say anything negative about my father. But what you're saying goes on often. Many women, because of their bitterness towards the way things might have worked out or didn't work out, whatever, will transfer that to the child, and unfortunately the child carries that into adult life.
It really does, and God, I mean, this segment today really is giving me more inspiration that I even knew was possible, and thank you for being so candid. So let's talk about
no
your
problem.
Book, you're welcome, From Gigolo to Jesus. How has it been received, and did you have any adverse reactions about the title?
Oh, it's funny that that's funny that you went there because it's been received extremely well. I think every independent author has to consider why they do what they do. Are you in this to make money? Are you in this because you got a message? Are you in this to – you have to think about whatever you're in it for. I got into this because I wanted to help others and I wanted to tell my story. When I wrote A Man in Transition, my first book, it was poetry, but it was poetry set to tell, you know, my story. It was my wife who said, you need to finish From Gigolo to Jesus because you need to let the world know, not in poetry form, but you need to let the world know who you are, how you got to be this person here. The book has been received, and, I mean, some critics have tried to attack me and say, well, you seem to harp on the sexual aspect. If I lived a life for 36 years filled with just sexual innuendo, sexual everything. Well, that's what a big part of my life was. I'm only 46 years old. So, mm-hmm. yes, it's going to be that, but I had to lead folks through that nastiness to get to an understanding that I've only known the Lord for a short time, but I'm so happy that I do now at the age that I am now, and it's getting brighter. And the Lord is opening up many doors, but I have to be able to tell the story completely because I think too often authors are scared to really tell the truth because They don't want someone to point their finger and go, that's just ridiculous. That's a shame. How could you? And I've gotten that. I've gotten some folks that just thought I was utterly disgusting, and they're well within their rights, and I have no problem with that. But I can honestly say I enjoyed writing the book. Now, the title, I did an interview about 5 months before the book was supposed to come out, and a woman said, you know, I just think you're a wonderful guy, and you have such a tremendous story, and I love you, your poetry, and but if you could just change the title. And I said, excuse me? She said, you're going to turn so many people off by putting Jesus on the cover. Not everybody's a Christian, and not everybody's going to, you know, and then you're saying from gigolo to Jesus, that's going to be offensive, maybe even to Christians. You know, you really need to change this. And I said, well, first of all, thank you. I always acknowledge comments because it's just proper. I said, but it is my story. When I say from gigolo to Jesus, no, I'm not calling myself Jesus, nor would I ever allow that to part my lips. But I'm going from a gigolo as somebody who becomes whatever the person is paying wants them to become. So if you want him to be your escort for the night, he's your escort. If you want him to be your lover for the night, he's your lover for the night. If you want him to act like he's your husband, he's a chameleon. He will become anything that you need him to become. That's what I was. The two Jesus part is that is what saved my life. My focus of trying to stay focused on what Jesus would have me do. So to Jesus is what I am working towards, what I am working to get to. So from what I was to where I'm going is what the title is about. And hence, if people would look at the cover, it's a highway. And on the highway, you see all this beautiful, serene area, and there's a symbol of Jesus off to the right, and it says highway to heaven. But if you look in the rearview mirror, there are faded pictures of all the women that I have been with.
Oh.
So it's all symbolic, and it's all connected. See, I don't believe in stock photos. I really try not to. I do not like them in the covers, and because I want a cover that my name is connected to mean something. And this was my book, and I was going to do it the way I wanted it, and that's why I left it. And so I've never worried about the flack because I knew when you put Jesus' name on things, yes, it's going to create some problems. But I can say I have seen within my family, I have seen within the families of others, I have seen young men that I have taught, I have seen young women that I have taught, I have seen people read my book and say, I understand it. You know what? I get it. I've seen young men say, wow, B, you really telling the story because that's what I'm going through. I've seen grown men say, yeah, you're right, because I was going through the same thing. Or, my story is the same way. I think I should write a book. And I've seen couples use my book to be able to open the door to conversations that they might not have had, but the boyfriend, husband, or whoever is able to say, yo, you see what he was talking about right there, what he was dealing with? That's what I was dealing with, but I didn't want to say anything. And I even addressed them to use the book that way. And I've seen women read it and say, wow, was I some of those women that allowed you to do those things to them? And maybe it helps heal, or maybe it uncovers something that they wasn't ready to deal with. But I've seen the greatness in my book. I just don't go out and beat people over the head to buy it. I'm not standing out on the street corners and guerrilla marketing you as you come out the store and push it in your hands. And you better get it, or stand outside churches and tell folks, you better get my book. The Lord said, but no. I just don't do that. It's not what I do. If you want it, it's there. And if you need me to come and speak, I'll come. And if you want to buy it, and people say I've lost money because I don't do that way. You know what? I just don't. I just know that the book is what it is, and I stand on it.
Oh, that's fantastic. For listeners today, we are having a very interesting and insightful conversation with Kale Belvin, the co-founder of Braven Publishing, LLC, and the author of the book, Gigolos to Jesus. So I wanted to move into, it seemed to me like it's a very perfect segue into teaching. And so let's talk about your role as an educator. What are some of the challenges you face dealing with young people, and how has dealing with them enriched your life?
Whew, now we're talking about my passion.
All right.
17 years now, teaching is a love of mine because I love young folks. I love young adults. Teaching has kept me grounded because I attempt every day I walk into a school to be the teacher that I needed when I was in eighth grade and when I was a dean in high school, what I needed when I was in high school. And right now I'm back in junior high school, what I know I needed in 6th, 7th, and 8th grade. Because when you teach in the urban areas that I have taught in and currently teaching in, they're dangerous. But I have no fears, and I don't have to park my car 6, 7, 8, 10 blocks away like some teachers do because they're worried about it. Never had to do that. In 17 years, I've never had damage done, just random damage done. I've had kids protect my children, my family, simply because they knew who I was. And I love the way children react when they're figuring something out in the classroom. I had a fantastic mentor. And my mentor gave me a bit of advice that I never forgot. The first day I came in for the training day before school started back in 1998, he said, I'm going to give you two pieces of advice that's going to help you teach for a long time. I was ready. I had the cardigan sweater on, and I was so overdressed for a training day, and everybody else was in shorts and flip-flops. I didn't know. He said, ready? I said, yes, I'm ready. He said, don't F with these kids' minds and mean what the F you say. Now, I heard the curse words. And I said, who curses at somebody at work? What kind of advice is that? So another brother came over and said, whatever he told you, his name was Genghis Noor. He was actually a former Black Panther and a teacher of 30-plus years, one of the greatest mentors I could ever have because he was rough. He was like a hard shot of whiskey. Ain't no chaser, no nothing. It's going down hard, and only certain people are drinking it. But the next brother that came over and said, whatever Genghis told you, hold on to it. I know it was probably rough because that's the way he gets down. And I stopped and I thought about it. But then the biggest thing was I went and watched him with children. He was a music teacher. The way he interacted with kids, it was incredible. Now, these are urban kids that some people say are out of control and can't be dealt with. And I watched the way he got them to give in, to give up all that foolishness, to listen to whatever he had. Well, I took that and I mixed it in with who I am and what I'm about. And kids know I care. Kids know I got their back. I see my students now 10 years later, and it's, hey, B, what's going on? I just was in the supermarket because I'm back in the neighborhood where I first started teaching. And a kid, I said, well, how you doing, man? Everything good? He said, I'm doing good, thanks to you. He said, I wouldn't have made it without you. Now, I try not to get emotional in front of them because, you know, I'm trying to be cool. I'm the tough Mr. B. I get in the car, and I told my wife, I'll never say nothing negative about teaching ever. Because when you see them grown up, that's the proof. So you can't see it when you first start teaching. No teacher can, and if they do tell you that, they're lying. When you plant that seed when a child is 13 or 14 years old, nobody knows what that kid is going to become when they grow up. But when you see them at 25, you see them at 26, you see them at 22, good or bad, if you did what you were supposed to, they're excited when they see you. They actually, you can tell that you taught them because they see you in the aisle and their eyes light up and you go, okay, I must have taught them even though I can't remember all the faces. And then you do. The minute you look through the beard or you look through the full body or you have to look up at some, they're about 6, 7, 6, whatever, you now see that 13-year-old. You see that 12-year-old. But they're a grown man now. They're a grown woman now. You had something to do with that. See, that's what a lot of teachers miss. We ain't never going to get paid what we're supposed to because people don't take teachers as serious as they should. Right. But the fact that you have an effect on somebody's life to where 20 years later they can still remember what you were teaching them then, man, I'd never give that up. And so that's what it's been for me, and that's what I bring to the classroom. Now, I have to tell the truth. These last couple of years, I'm dragging a little bit. I'm tired because the system has put me in a position where I can't be social with kids as I would like to because they want us to teach to the exam. And I'm anti the exam, and so I get myself in a lot of trouble. My first 8 years, one of those years I was teacher of the year, by the PTA voted me teacher of the year. But my last 7 has been difficult because I've been in 5 schools in the last 7 years because principals have gotten upset that I spend too much time socializing with the kids or trying to get the kids out of situations, and they say, well, that's not our concern. How can a kid's livelihood at home or his health or his life not be our concern? I've dealt with gang situations, child pornography, murders. I've dealt with shootings, stabbings. I've dealt with everything from venereal diseases, even HIV. In the years that I've been teaching, and to tell me that that's not important and that these exams are, I can't rock with that. And so right now I'm actually looking to possibly change careers because I can't see the Department of Education swinging back to where they're going to let us teach the way we should teach. So actually I'm looking to get into counseling, so I'm going to start working on my second master's degree once my baby's born, because I want to do something different to help the community that I live in and work in.
You know, I think there's so much rich content in what you just described, and when these politics get into the classrooms, it messes mm-hmm. with dynamic teachers. And I know there's a history of teachers who have been nonconformist, such as, you know, the teacher that Samuel Jackson played in Coach Carter, where there's
yes.
probably a little cussing and a problem. Because you really do. These kids come to school broken already. They're already dealing with a bunch of stuff at home from parents who were probably not educated and or parents that were dealing with substance abuse or whatever other issues. So what you're doing is you are helping break the chain, and I think it's just so sad that you have to identify that, you know, you're kind of fighting a battle and having to shift it to come at a different angle to be able to still reach those kids. And you are an intellectual thoroughbred. You already hold several degrees, and you know you're moving toward this PhD. And I just thank God for men and teachers like you that understand the plight of the kids that are out there. I just got through seeing Fruitvale Station, and that's the tale of Oscar Grant, and you know how he
yes.
was executed
I
up on the Park
yes.
platform. Oh, my God. And they did it just right. I'm glad they didn't go into the court scene and all that other stuff. But there are a lot of struggles in the urban community still to this day. And there are a lot of kids that are just so – I think the biggest thing that I heard out of that is that you and the brother that you mentioned that was with the Black Panther, you almost have to know the streets to be able to get into their heads, to even be able
to start
helping them sort it out. So I want to go ahead and move into something else. I'm looking at the clock, 10 minutes we've got. So we spoke yesterday, and you have some powerful insight about what makes a strong marriage and what keeps the relationship thriving and successful, and because so many marriages fail. So what are your thoughts that you'd like to share with the listeners about what keeps a marriage strong and a relationship strong?
Oh, man, thank you. You know what? A marriage, if the two of you can come to an agreement that you want to do better for and with each other, and once you can come to the table that way, and also you should be friends before, because if you're friends before and you have the mindset that I just mentioned, now when the two of you make that commitment to be husband and wife, when you grow stronger together, the world changes. Y'all see the world differently. Even the way you think and speak changes. And the beauty of that is people respond to it. People see that, and they gravitate to it. They can see real love. It's why people love President Obama and his wife. It's what they see. Even though they've never met him, don't even know anything about him, it's what they mm-hmm. appear to be. It's what they like about Will Smith and his wife. And that's why when we see certain marriages that we thought would last forever, when we hear about them not making it, we go, a part of us aches because we go, oh, that was my couple.
Yeah.
But it's also when we see the elders, the 40, 50, 60, 70-year married, something about you go. Something inside of us about them makes us go, oh, because we know what it took to get to that point. We know
wow.
what it took to be with somebody 50 years, 60 years, or you live to the point that y'all die. You actually left. You made it till death do you part. You made it there. Most people don't get there. So
right.
the idea is that we're not selling marriage like that. We're selling it as cosmetic. And you said a great word yesterday with this instant. This instant gratification.
Right.
Well, we're in a microwave time period where everything seems to be instant. And if you don't like that first marriage, toss it to the side and get you another one. If that don't work, get a third one. And we make jokes about it. I said when I failed at my first marriage, I messed that up. I was in a marriage. I wasn't married. I failed that because I failed my first wife because I did not love her the way love was supposed to be given, because I should have never been in that marriage. I was with her for 8 years, and I can't remember a happy year. And that's my fault. So once I got married a second time, I told my wife, this is it. If this don't work, that's it. Because if I don't get this right now, it don't make no sense to me. And so all that energy went into how to make this work. And then how can I take this, bottle it, and show other people so they could want it. Now, not want my marriage because you ain't getting my wife. But get your own,
that.
Like the old BET commercial. No, no, my brother, you got to get your own. But the idea is, but the idea is that if we start, especially in the African, Caribbean, and Latino community. Now, our Latino brothers and sisters, they hold on to marriages, but they still need to shape them up a little bit. But especially in the African and Caribbean communities here in the United States, if we can get our brothers and sisters to start buying into the idea that marriage for life. Then we can start to change some of the social problems that we have because that two-family home starts to reinvent itself. It starts to reestablish itself. And then automatically we can start to carve some of these negatives away and start to rebuild what we've been missing. We used to have that. And so my wife and I try to live that. We try to be that. Even our difficult times, we live our life out loud. We put it on Facebook. Right now, going through our we're 9-8 weeks away from having our first child together. People go, "Is it your first?" We go, "Our first, my seventh." And they look at me like, "Oh my God, no, don't look like that. Listen to what I said." And I smile when I say our first, and I smile when I say our seventh, because you know what? You can judge us any way you want. We're excited. This is our first child. We lost a child 7 years ago. We're so happy that the Lord picked us to be able to bring a child into this world because we're ready. So if we can get other folks to take the same tact to love, to find somebody that you love and live it that way. We put it all on Facebook so folks can go, "I'm so tired of them," so you say, but you keep tuning in and checking us out. Because we want folks to see that it's not an institution. It's an embodiment. When you really love somebody and you connected to somebody, the idea of not being with them tears at you. That actually becomes the foundation to not doing some of the foolishness that's out there.
Right.
And so this is what we do. This is what we try to live.
I think that you and Tiffany are excellent muse for people that are looking to have strong relationships. And the conviction, you know, especially the approach, the creation of the publication company, as well as the Block Talk Radio show called Reality and Relationships that you both do, it's that you are doing everything together. It's not like you're living life independent, and I think that that has a great deal to do with it. So as I look at the time, I want to go ahead and make sure that we know where your books can be purchased and how to tune in to your Block Talk radio show, Reality and Relationships. How can we purchase your books? And how can we tune in?
Definitely. You can purchase our books at our website, www.bravin, B-R-A-V-I-N, publishing.com, and also klthewriter.com. And to tune into our radio show, all you have to do is go to GQ Palace. blogtalkradio.com/GQ, which is GEEQUE-Palace. And Thursday nights from 8 to 10, just click on the link to Reality and Relationships, and you'll be able to find us. Also, if you want to listen to the archives of all our shows, you can go to klbelvin.blogspot.com. That's my blog. And I post up all our shows pretty much later on that night if you miss it. So you can always go back and listen to all our shows, and I put a detail of what the shows are about. And so you can find us that way.
All right, that sounds fantastic. So everyone, we've been spending a very insightful 45 minutes with KL Belvin, the co-founder of Bravin Publications, LLC, and the author of From Gigolos to Jesus. So definitely go out and support
his effort. Bravin Publishing. I'm sorry. It's Bravin Publishing.
Yeah, Bravin
Publishing.
I saw that.
Bravin Publishing.
Yeah, I missed that one. Bravin Publishing. Thank you for that. And I would hope that you guys go out and purchase that on Wednesday, January 22nd at 1:30 p.m. Howard Hewitt is going to be in the house. I'm very excited about that interview because he's someone that I've admired for so long, and he's been out there doing it for a while. He is a legend in his own right, so hopefully you will tune in. And with that, I just wanted to know, K.L. Belvin, what are your final thoughts today that you would like to leave the A Touch of Grace listeners with?
Anybody listening, and I first want to say thank you, Touch of Grace, for having me on, but anyone listening, understand God is real. But you have to commit to doing the works that you were designed to do so the Lord can open the doors, remove the hurdles from in front of you. Trust that you have talents that make you uniquely unique and allow the Lord to be who he is. And if you do that, blessings will come. Maybe not the way that you think, but there will be blessings nonetheless. K.L. Belvin.
All right. K.L. Belvin is a prime example of what happens when you allow God to take control of your life. He is a father of six, a dean and an educator of students for the New York City Department of Education, where he's been for 16 years. That encore presentation was an honor. In listening to it again, I just realized that there are some incredible people in the world today. Now, I'm excited about three upcoming shows. Tomorrow, Friday, the 27th of February at 1:30, A Touch of Grace will be interviewing the dynamic singer and theater performer, Darius DeHaas. He caught my attention with the duet he sang with the legendary singer-actress, former Miss America, even though she had her crown relinquished. She's still accomplished, but I love that duet, Just Friends, that they sang together, and that's what caught my attention, and I'm so glad that he agreed to do the show. Then on Thursday the 5th, which is my father's birthday, by the way, I'll be interviewing the dynamic stage performer, Anthony Wayne, who plays the lead role in Mighty Reel, a fabulous Sylvester musical. So he'll be here. And then on Friday, the best-selling author, William Cooper, joins us to talk about his latest novel release, Unbreakable. Remember, this is your life, and as far as I know, we only get one. Do with it that which brings you fulfillment and joy, because God didn't put us here to be mediocre reflections of his glory. He intended for us to shine just as bright as a racing comet across a midnight sky. And know this, GD loves you very much. With that, have a great weekend. See you later.